You're listening to Radiotopia Presents from PRX's Radiotopia.
Hi, I'm Willa Paskin, the host of Decoder Ring, Slate's podcast about cracking cultural mysteries. On Decoder Ring, we dive down rabbit holes and obsessively explore questions hiding in plain sight. Like, why has slow dancing gone out of style? And when did we all become obsessed with hydration? And where did the word mullet, you know, to describe a hairstyle, come from? That's Decoder Ring, named one of the best podcasts of 2023 by the New York Times. Listen to new episodes every 2 weeks and make sure to follow us so you never miss one.
Let's see. Does that work?
Yes. Yeah. Right. Do you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you. Do you hear me?
Yes, absolutely. It sounds even better than our phone. Yeah.
My mother's a jazz singer, Nancy Harrow. She was pregnant with me when she posed for the cover of her second album for Atlantic Records in 1963. The photos carefully cropped so no one could tell.
The sky was blue and high above.
I'm sure my mother sang to me as much as talked when I was a baby. One of my earliest memories is her singing a Nat Adderley tune while keeping time on the soles of my feet.
Now I reckon that ought to get it because I'm working.
Right.
It's just that I liked it and it was very rhythmic, and when I would be changing you or something, that's what I would do.
Yeah, so you would play it on my feet while you were changing me? Do you think my memory goes back that far?
Of course, I think it does.
No wonder I became a drummer. But your mother doesn't have to be a jazz singer to have memories of being sung to as a baby. Everyone sings to babies. Melody is part of the way we learn language. Think about it. Before we know words, we know the sound of a voice speaking them, or rather, singing them. Because what is language without words? It's the sound of a voice, a musical sound.
When I remember every little
thing. I think you know, before you could speak, you could still understand what I was saying. The child I've heard recognizes the sound of his mother's voice because he was hearing it in the womb.
Right.
That's what people say. Yeah.
So does that mean I heard you do your overdubs on your Atlantic album?
No, what you really must have heard was when I was in Baltimore and I was playing Ray Charles all day long. And
Wait, what were you doing in Baltimore singing Ray Charles all day long?
We understand the voices of those we love so well, even better than we understand their words sometimes. And when we share our voices, whether through song or speech, aren't we always saying more than our words? We're sharing sounds so basic to our understanding that they precede language. But the way we often hear voices today, even of those we're closest to, is mediated by technology. Technologies that extend the reach of our voice across space, across time. But does all of our voice make it through that transmission? Not just the part with the words, but the part that came before that, the part that expresses more than we can say. Because if it doesn't, are we really saying all that we mean? This is Ways of Hearing, a six-part podcast from Radiotopia's Showcase, exploring the nature of listening in our digital world. I'm Damon Krukowski, a musician and a writer. In each episode, we'll look at a different way that the switch from analog to digital audio is changing our perceptions of time, of space, of love, money, and power. This is about sound, the medium we're sharing together now. But I'm worried about the quality of that sharing, because we don't seem to be listening to each other very well right now in the world. Our voices carry further than they ever did before, thanks to digital media. But how are they being heard? Episode 3, Love. Love songs are universal. And there's a universal fascination with those who sing them.
I read so many varied reports written by MDs, by psychiatrists, by psychologists, and it ranged from the fact that they were rooting for the boy next door, all the way up to a sex symbol, you might say.
That's Frank Sinatra, speaking in 1965. He's trying to explain why people feel close to him, even if he doesn't know them at all.
But I really have no specific answer. I just think that the crooner, or a troubadour, let's put it that way, I think has been a symbol of entertainment that people have been attracted to for many, many years. I think they've admired anybody who can get up and sing a love song.
What is it about his voice that draws us in?
None but.
Or what is it about the way he recorded that voice?
Yeah, I love recording. I think making records is a great fun of all times.
Sinatra not only loved recording, he was a master at it. Singers everywhere still admire his microphone technique. He perfected an address to the microphone, carefully controlling his breath and diction so that he could move very close to it without the disruption of unwanted sounds like the pops and hisses of consonants. So close, it can feel like he's singing right in our ear.
If any popping of peas, let's stop. Because there were too many of the peas popping in the past dates we did.
At other times, he backed away from the mic and let us feel the power of his voice. That constant adjustment of his distance to the microphone makes full use of what audio engineers call proximity effect. All microphones, if you speak closely to them, exaggerate the bassier, chestier tones in our voices. And if you back away from them, they highlight the brassier, clearer tones. Sinatra's control of proximity effect was a part of his communication of feeling, in addition to the words of a song. Not that he wasn't very particular about those words.
The biggest complaint I have about a lot of the kids who sing today is that I can't understand what they're saying. If I could only understand some of the words, I might be more interested in what they're doing, but I can't. There's no enunciation and there's no clarity of diction.
But now the days are.
But it isn't just the words of the songs that come through in Sinatra's recordings. After all, many singers of his era could enunciate. There's something else, again, about the way Sinatra communicated with his voice. Something some of those kids he complained about could actually do pretty well, too. When the Beatles swept into the USA for the first time in 1964, the year right before that Sinatra interview, many older listeners complained that they couldn't make out any of their lyrics. But the feeling of what they were singing was clear, clear to millions. Rock and roll lyrics are so often misheard, there's a whole genre of YouTube videos devoted to spelling out the wrong words to hit songs. In that way, Sinatra was right. If rock and roll depended on enunciation and clarity of diction, it would be a non-starter. But what Sinatra was missing is that Mick Jagger's non-verbal communication over the mic, everything that's not in his words, was not so different than his own. Great rock singers like Jagger may not enunciate, but they do get all the feeling in their voices across, feeling that's built on the sound of a voice.
I was always attracted to people's voices, and my aunt took me to a psychic and recorded the tarot card reading, and it was like an hour long, and I used to play that tape over and over and over again when I was 14, 15 years old to go to sleep. I listened to it every single night. So I like this like calm, explanatory tone, and I wanted to use that.
If you listen to podcasts, and I know you do, you probably recognize that voice. It's Roman Mars, host of the very popular program about design called 99% Invisible. I wouldn't be surprised if some people listen to that podcast just to hear Roman's voice, the same way he played that psychics tape over and over. Did you know you had a great radio voice? Like, were you told
no.
that at some point? No. Mm-hmm.
No, in the beginning, I was convinced that I could only be a behind-the-scenes producer because my voice was so terrible. And so I used to fill in on Morning Edition, at KLW 91.7 in San Francisco. And because Morning Edition, you have to get in at 4:30 in the morning, I would like come in and barely be awake, have not spoken to anybody, and it would be very much like, this is 91.7. Like, I would be very, it'd be so low, it'd be Barry White type low. And I just kind of learned how to harness the parts of the calm I could create, the parts of that were resonating in my head in ways that I enjoyed.
Baby, please don't do that.
Roman wasn't born with that late night radio DJ voice. He had to discover it and develop it together with a microphone technique, a technique that depends on being very, very close to the mic.
In the beginning, I would record it in my bedroom at night. My kids were really little.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars.
So I had to create something that looked more like a field mic and just use it really low and really close to my mouth so that I could kind of work in any untreated room I needed to.
Putting the mic that close to his mouth, Roman exaggerates its proximity effect. Like Sinatra, or Barry White for that matter, leaning into the mic gives us the feeling that he's leaning in close to us, his listeners. So we are actually now recording ourselves in two different ways, mm-hmm. and I want to reveal that a little bit. So you're speaking, I take it, on your favorite mic.
Yep.
And so we're each here on our favorite mics, but then we're also speaking on a cell phone connection.
And I wanted to let people hear what that sounds like as a difference, because
they know your voice very well over your favorite mic, but a lot of people out there haven't necessarily spoken to you on the telephone.
I don't talk to many people on the phone all that much. And I've gotten to the point where people call me, it's like it feels aggressive, you know, like I'm not expecting it.
Mm-hmm. And I assume, like me, you had analog phones at one point in your life.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I remember being 13 or 14 year old and sitting on the floor next to a corded phone in the kitchen for hours on end and never getting tired of it. You know, like there was even periods of silence that I remember where nothing was happening or you'd just be watching TV and you'd still stay on the phone. Now I don't have any tolerance for that whatsoever. Like, it's one of the rare pieces or a designed object where the quality is so much worse with weird latency issues and digital artifacts of compressing and decompressing. And I feel like over half my calls end up being interrupted by something, by some kind of sound problem. And it's like, well, why commit to anything in depth when there's a 60% chance that it could just end awkwardly right in the middle of your great moment that you're sharing with somebody?
As Roman points out, the sound of our voices on the phone has gotten worse with the switch to digital. But it's not because the microphones in them have gotten worse. In fact, the miniature mics in our cell phones are much more sensitive than the ones we used in our big old analog phones. Yet we hear less of one another on the phone now. And no matter how close we hold them to our mouths, there's no proximity effect on a cell phone. Everyone sounds just as near or just as far as everyone else. The reason is that unlike the old analog phones, cell phones don't transmit the full range of sound picked up by their mics. Instead, they digitally process that sound, compressing it to remove whatever engineers have decided is unnecessary data. That efficiency makes the remarkable reach of digital communications possible. Just like any other lossy compression, the reduction of recordings into MP3s, photographs into JPEGs, film into YouTube videos. The compression of our voices on the cell phone makes for smaller data packets that are easier to share over digital networks. Engineers know these lossy formats are less than ideal, but they're intended to get the essential information across. But what is the essential part of our voices, and what isn't? Cell phones are engineered to communicate our words above all. Everything else is pushed aside. The background noise that indicates where we are, and the myriad small sounds that indicate we're there too. The sounds of our breathing, the sounds of our listening. That's why we used to be able to hang on the analog phone with one another for hours, sometimes without even talking. We could feel one another's presence.
I was always on the phone.
Who'd you talk to the most?
Daddy, and then Liz and Betty.
Do you remember all their phone numbers?
I remember all their phone numbers. Elizabeth Havermeyer, 96448. And Barbara's was the Susquehanna, 74695.
Susquehanna?
Give me and my baby a fuss and fight.
I don't remember Daddy's phone number. He must have called me all the time. I don't remember his phone number.
Ain't nobody's business. Nobody's business if I do.
I dialed the wrong number. I dialed Ellie's number with Liz's extension, and I got this man on the phone who started to flirt with me. I hung up because it was frightening, and I told the story to Liz, and she kept calling this guy up and gave him her phone number and everything, and she had a long flirtation on the telephone with some strange man who must have lived in Queens somewhere.
She called him deliberately?
Yes, deliberately, because that's what she was like, yeah.
So, but you could flirt on the phone. Do you think people can still flirt on the phone? That's what I wonder, because it sounds so terrible.
I don't think you can. It doesn't sound the same. It's not as intimate.
What is it about that?
Well, because you could regulate your voice by the distance you were from it and the way in which you spoke and whether you made it husky. So that's just like a microphone.
What's lost on the cell phone is the part of our voices that communicates without language. The part we use for flirting. The part that rock and roll leans on. The part that Sinatra was so expert at getting on a record.
And no one cares.
Gary Tomlinson is a musicologist who thinks on a grand scale. And he believes that our ability to communicate with the nonverbal parts of our voices goes so deep, it's not only in our memories from early childhood, it's coded into the genetic makeup of our species itself. Before we had language, he explains, meaning hundreds of thousands of years ago, we had utterances. Utterances with musical qualities. And those musical qualities communicated what we needed to survive as a species. Tool making, social organization, and I would assume, love.
Music and language, in their deep, deep histories, I see the antecedents of these things falling into place along kind of parallel tracks that overlap one another but are not the same track. And, you know, linguistics professors these days, they tend to focus on syntax and grammar, and they tend to leave out the musical aspects of language, the tunes of my speech. And if you do that, of course, you're going to leave out exactly the overlapping part that is so important.
Right. Makes me think also of what's going on technologically for us right now, because to encode our language, send it over the internet, and make it perceivable at the other end of this great space of distance, the nonverbal qualities of our voices tend to be lost in that coding. Does that relate, do you think, to your sense of the musical aspects of speech?
No question that that's right. There is so much left out. It's so interesting to think about what is absent from what in fact gets reproduced across these technological systems that of which we have so many in these days. But the other side is the miraculous way in which human beings fill in what is left out. So I'm hearing you across FaceTime. There's a lot that is captured of what you're saying and how you say it. There's no doubt other stuff that isn't there, and yet I'm projecting it into it somehow. I'm hearing it, I'm reconstructing you in a way, as you reconstruct me. That's an extraordinary capacity. You know, we are always able to recognize voices almost instantaneously, even though we're getting a small portion of what those voices would give us if we were standing face to face with each other and hearing them. It's quite extraordinary.
Right. Oh, did I lose you? Oh, Gary, are you there?
Great.
I lost you for a second.
I'm here.
Hold on a second. Sure.
Hey, guys. Are you online? Okay, could you stay off for a moment more?
Digital tools make it possible to share our words across great distances. But they fail us in so many ways as we try to communicate one to one. Not only are we often left hanging, speaking into the air at one end and listening to nothing at the other, But even when all is working as it's supposed to, the sound of our voice across digital lines is limited. It's stripped to that minimum we need to recognize a voice and decode its words. But words don't say everything. Gary Tomlinson has a beautiful phrase to express this. He's written that there are musical absences at the heart of language. We are musical beings, Gary believes, as much as linguistic ones. And I have to agree, not only because I happen to play music, and not only because my mother happens to be a singer, but because my mother sang to me.
Ain't nobody's business if I do.
Did your parents sing to you?
My father sang. He would sing a cappella in the car always. Because I remember he sang this very haunting song that was about a prisoner in the cell. I mean, he told me what it was about because it was in Yiddish. It was, I remember the chorus was Oy Fegela, which was the prisoners looking out at and see the bird flying outside.
Yeah.
And it was it's so mournful, that song. And it was always made me feel very mournful.
So it's like a blues.
Yes, it was like a blues. It was. Oh, Fegela, da di da dum, da di da dum. Dee-da-da-dum, dee-da-da-dum, dee-da-da-dum-da-dum. Oh, merveilichen Gumben. Gumben and Gumben.
This is Ways of Hearing. In the next episode, we'll look at a different kind of human exchange and consider how digital audio has changed the way music intersects with money. Thank you for listening. Ways of Hearing is a production of Showcase from Radiotopia and PRX, produced by me, Damon Krukiewski, Max Larkin, and Ian Koss, with sound design by Ian Koss. Our executive producer is Julie Shapiro. Thanks to Alex Bronstein and the PRX Podcast Garage. Our theme song is Trickle Down by Robert Wyatt. Find out more about Ways of Hearing at radiotopia.fm/showcase.
Open your window, let them in, and then pull back your curtains, hurry, so you can hear. Listen to the hum as it rises, riding the breeze, leaving gravity's children
Radiotopia.